everyone. It's the Life of Gem audio podcast, Writers on Writing. And today I have one of my favorite people in the world here, Elsa Valmigiano. Say hello.
Hi.
Elsa's the author of two books, We Are No Longer Babylon and The Beginning of Leaving, which just came out last year. And we'll talk about both those books. But just to set us in space and time for posterity's sake, today is Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. We are going to be releasing this episode by Friday or Saturday, so watch out for it. And when you listen to it, please drop me a note in the comments or a review, and I have a copy of Elsa's book to give away. Okay, so if you leave a review or you leave a note or a comment on the podcast page, whichever one, just Instagram it to me or Facebook it to me at Life of Gem, and I will send you a free copy of the book to the first person who does that. Okay, so I'm going to read Elsa's bio, and then we're going to get into the interview after she does a short reading. Philippine born and LA raised, Elsa Valmigiano is an essayist and a poet whose debut essay collection, We Are No Longer Babylon, was a recipient of the Editor's Choice selection from New Rivers Press Many Voices Project competition in prose. Her work appears in Anomaly, Cherry Tree, Hair Streak Butterfly Review, and Mother. Her work is also widely anthologized and recently appears in Unbound, Composing Home by New Rivers Press, and Not Ghosts But Spirits, Volume 1, an anthology of women, queer, trans, and NB issues. The Beginning of Leaving is her second essay collection. And I'm just going to just really quick read my blurb on it because I think it's really how I feel. It encapsulates exactly how I feel about her book. In this stunning tour de force, Elsa takes us on a magical travel-filled journey and mining of the self, spanning decades, continents, and generations. It is an excavation filled with reconciliation, grief, epiphanies, and longing. Touching on Filipino culture and displacement, reproduction, colonialism, and generational trauma, along with the joys of family. Her book bears witness to the personal and political implications of digging deep. Valmigiano implores us to stop, to listen, to inhale it in. Her prose and poetry shimmer with intensity and brilliance, like a mythical lullaby, urging us to lean in. Welcome, Elsa.
Thank you for having me. Yay.
You know, I first read your book last year and I read it multiple times because I wrote a long review of this book, and you can find it on Women Who Submit blog. And I just love your book so much. So do you mind reading some from it, 5 to 7 minutes to start, and then we'll get into the interview?
Sure, of course. You know what? I'm just going to read the opening poem. I think it's a good way of opening the collection and just kind of conjuring ancestors and just kind of being in the present. So it's called What We Were Meant To. Are we born feet first to hit the ground running? Our hearts already exposed, slashed open to bleed? See this hair, a growth of tendrils. See this face, my foot emerging. See these eyes, my toes. See this rigid chin, the heel of my foot. See this cheek, the palm of my foot. Not feeling the caress of your hand, but earth herself, to walk her body. And this is the way she cradles me, in the valley of her mountain's embrace. Sings me lullabies with the roar of her oceans and runs her fingers through my leafy hair as her kisses are the wind rustling through trees. I am born this diasporic foot. But do you see two perfectly formed heads, or are they bulbs emerging from the birth canal like Jacob and Esau, where a white god dictated one must be the underdog, when maybe our ancestors narrate us as simply community? our collective foot, delivering us to new destinations together. Ilocano Nanangs of old say that children born feet first have the ability to save you from choking on a fishbone by lightly stroking your throat, when maybe those who choke have stayed or tarried too long, when the fishbone, well, don't fish live in the sea where we are meant to be, and the fishbone tickles you, nudges you to leave for God's sakes already by boat, by legs, and this diasporic foot, my foot, your foot, our face. Can you tell we are smiling, crying, pulled by the foot from the birth canal to just go? Blood drop, tear drop down our slashed heart cheek. Or maybe it's our bleeding mouth, barely open to protest what we were born to do. See our 7,000 leafy tendrils, interwoven with water as a swirling grid of streets we were meant to cross.
Wow. I just, you know, there's something about the way, and I really want to talk about this in a little bit. I want to get into the deep way that you structured your book. Lately on this podcast, we've been talking to a lot of writers about sequencing. And I always say that my favorite albums are like my favorite books. They're sequenced perfectly. If you look at Ziggy Stardust, beginning to end, it's a whole story by David Bowie. So I want to talk about that. But first, I want to talk about the segue from this poem into our discussion. And this poem references a foot. And on the cover of the book, on the beginning of Leaving Book that everyone needs to get, there's a picture of a foot. And it looks like you did a sort of collage with another photo. And the photo on the cover is Nectar by Andrea Guerrero. Yes. Do you want to talk just really quick about what the foot means? Is it the foot out of the birth canal?
Yeah, you know, actually, I'm going to tell a little story about the cover, because it's really important with how the book even opens up. So when I was working on the beginning of Leaving, you know, some of these pieces have been written like, you know, almost 10 years ago. But when the collection started coming together, I would say it started coming together in 2021. And I had read an essay by Una Patrick called Nobody Goes to Mertola, which is published in The Common. And she talks about this like Buldong's Roman experience she was having in Mertola. And it kind of inspired me to write about my experience in Australia, which I had never written about. And that was a big Buldong's Roman experience for me. And for anyone who doesn't know what Buldong's Roman means, it means coming of age. I believe it's a German word. And
now I know how to say it. I always knew it because Portrait of the Artist by James Joyce is a coming of age story.
Yes,
and it's often referred to as that. So
yeah, Buldong's Roman. And so I thought it was finally time to write about it, just because Una's story really triggered me in that moment of time about leaving. And just about like finding yourself at such a young age, like maybe not completely finding yourself, you know, because we're so young, right? I was like 20 going on 21. And it's such a young age where I think that even people today of you know, being 20 and 21, that there's this pressure to already know who you are. And when you look back on it in hindsight, it's like, how could you know who you possibly are? I mean, I guess some people do. I don't know. But I know for me, I just felt this tremendous pressure to already know who I was at that age, which then that experience in Australia then shaped the trajectory of a lot of decision making I would make in my life, you know, in the future and even today.
What's funny is to ready myself for this, I've read your book a number of times, but I reread a few of the stories, and that was one of them. The one that where you go to Australia. Very interesting.
Yeah. And so what ended up happening was that I befriended someone. Her name is Andrea Guerrero, and she is Pinay, and she is diasporic in the Bahamas. So she's been raised in, you know, many locations, but the Bahamas is one of the locations where she was primarily raised. And we became really great friends. We actually share like Ilocano ancestry, which was like a big deal. And
so you're related?
I guess we are, but we have like such ancestry, like all the way up the tree that it's like through like great.
Wow.
It's like you're not related anymore, like through the Peirce-Derby system, but I kind of feel that we are regionally. And so we became really, just really great, intimate friends. And she's a visual artist as well as a poet. And we would have these really long discussions that would last like hours and hours and hours. And we talk about being diasporic. And one of the things is that she had, and this is kind of crazy, but it was back in October, it was October 13th, 2021. She had sent me this drawing, which you see now on the cover of The Beginning of Leaving.
Wow.
And I actually had not drafted the poem of what we were meant to yet. I actually drafted that poem as an ekphrastic response to the drawing. And that ultimately opened up the collection. So without
and just for people who don't know, can you tell people what a euphrastic
ekphrastic poem? So an ekphrastic piece is basically the written word that is in response to a visual piece. And so this poem was born out of my response to this drawing that Andrea Guerrero had made. And that's what's called a ekphrastic response or ekphrastic poem. And so, when I saw it, I just felt that it encapsulated what was being captured in the essay collection as a whole. And so once I saw it, I was like, this is it. This is the cover. And so she became my cover artist and had taken an image. So the background is actually Murujuga in Australia.
Oh, I wondered if that's where it was. Yeah.
It is a photograph that I took back in 1998. And so it was July 1998. And I had taken this photo and she placed it as the backdrop, with her drawing on top. So she basically, designed the whole cover. And I just thought it was so perfect because it captured really like the beginning of the beginning of the essay collection, while the backdrop, the landscape of Murujuga, captures the ending. And I just thought it was such a nice, it encapsulates everything about the collection. And just, I thought, this is perfect. So.
And then when you wrote this poem, you talk about Jacob and Esau, who from the Bible, the older brother and younger brother, who are kind of, rivals.
Yeah.
And I love that when you talk about the white God who dictates one must be the underdog, it really is about colonialism, right?
Yeah.
There's always an other, a less than. So beautifully done. Oh my gosh. I love that so much.
Thank
you. Tell me really quick, the press that you went with, how do you say their name?
It's Carencia.
Okay. They're fantastic. They did a beautiful job.
Yeah.
How they set this out. How'd you find your press?
Okay, that's another long story. So I actually wrote a retelling of the Manananggal. And to give you some background on what the Manananggal is, the Manananggal is a folkloric creature from the Philippines. She's a very feminist creature, supernatural being who... Basically, by day, she's this beautiful woman. Mm. And at night, she transforms into this creature that... I'm sorry, I have to take a pause because it's going to be like, what the hell? She's a creature at night. So she transforms where she dislodges from her legs and her torso, you know, separates from the legs. And so she flies around and she's basically a viscera sucker. So she is a fetus eater.
Oh, wow.
And she's very symbolic of women's autonomy, women's agency over their own bodies, very ahead of her time. And so I had written a retelling of that folklore, and I had it published in Mythos. And the editor-in-chief of Mythos, she was published with Carencia in their anthology.
Oh.
So I had looked into Carencia because of where I was published previously for the Manananggol story. So that's how I got connected with Carencia.
And was their anthology the one that Not Ghosts But Spirits Volume 1? Is that the one you're referencing?
So there was another anthology before that, which was a general themed anthology, which she had been part of. And so that's how I got connected with Carencia, because of that. Mm. But they had put their call out for Not Ghosts But Spirits. And I thought, oh my God, I have the perfect, you know, poems for this. So then I submitted. And then from there, I got acquainted with their press. And Emily Perkovich is the editor-in-chief there. And she's an amazing human being. She's an amazing editor. She's one of my dearest friends now because of this whole publishing experience. But that's basically how I found Carencia. So it was through the channels of publishing another story, which then brought me to Carencia.
Yes, I love this press. I was not aware of them until you put your book out. But Carencia Press, just for those of you who want to look it up and get Elsa's book and look at their catalog, it's spelled Q-U-E-R-E-N-C-I-A. And I believe that their website is carenciapress.com. So just go to that and check out their catalog. And they do really interesting stuff. And the way they did your book, there's also pictures, both color and black and white. Mm-hmm. Is that something you knew you wanted to do? Because not every memoir essay collection has pictures, but I really do think yours sets it.
Yeah, you know, when I originally submitted the manuscript, it didn't have pictures. I was just ready to, you know, publish it like I did We Are No Longer Babylon, which didn't have photographs in it. And it was actually Emily Perkovich, who's the editor-in-chief of Carencia Press. She is the one who actually strongly suggested that I include photographs. And I thought, you know, that suggestion was just so awesome. And I was very welcome to submitting photographs to accompany, you know, the collection. But, you know, honestly, I didn't even dream of doing it. Like, I just had the manuscript ready and I submitted it. And so when she made the suggestion, when it was, you know, when we're going through the editing process together, and we had a very long editorial process together, I think we did like 6 passes to really get this manuscript extremely polished, as you see now. Yeah, she's the one that made the suggestion, and she's the one who made the suggestions for, you know, the recommended reading in case anyone had any questions about, you know, my sources. I mean, she's really extraordinary for any author who wants to work with her. I mean, she is so diligent.
It's so interesting because, you know, I'm part of this binders group, this nonfiction binders group. And someone recently put up a post about a big 5 publishing thing where they didn't get any support. And then you hear about these independent, what some might call small press, independent press. I don't believe either is pejorative, but some people don't like the term small press. Let's call it an independent press. And they give you like this kind of support. They put out this beautiful product because in the end, it is a product, right? And we want it to look professional and beautiful. And so people need to get the beginning of leaving. It's just so beautifully, even typeset, the pictures you chose to put in here.
Yeah.
The way they did the hybrid, which is not always easy when you're putting poetry and prose together. But let's talk about the first story in the piece. So the first poem is What We Were Meant To.
Yeah.
And then the first story is called First Home. Mm-hmm. And I love writers that write about place. So talk about what that story is about and why you decided to put that as the first prose piece.
Okay. So one of the things about First Home, actually, First Home originally appeared in New Rivers Press, which was my first press, in an anthology about home, and it was called Unbound. And the editor-in-chief, or the managing editor of that press, Nate Rehnquist, who also is a very dear friend of mine, he had put out a call about what home means, which could be very many different definitions. Mm. And I think for me, who's lived in so many places, I was like, I honestly don't know what home is. It's kind of scary because I've lived in so many places. And so, you know, I asked him, like, what are you looking for exactly? Like, especially for people who have so many homes that they could claim home. And he was like, well, exactly. That's what I'm talking about. Whatever you feel is your definition of home. And so, so how First Home came about was because I was an infant immigrant. I think there's this whole idea about for babies who immigrate that because they're babies, that they don't have any sense of like what movement is or, you know, big things like immigrating. And, you know, being an infant myself, you know, who went through that experience and then hearing stories from my parents about how I was during that experience, which sounded pretty traumatic actually, because my mother did say that like I had screamed from Honolulu to LAX, like 5.5 hours without pause. Like she literally sounded like you were, it sounded like you were being murdered, like as you were, you know, crying.
She called it blood curling. That's on page 30 for people who are,
yeah,
who are following along. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and she said like, you know, you just wouldn't stop crying. And luckily the plane wasn't crowded. So I don't think I like bothered a lot of people, although the people that were on the plane were very like, oh my God, like shut this kid up. You know, as my mom says, you were like everyone's favorite baby on that plane. So I wanted to write about that because I think we underestimate how the experience of immigration does affect children, even the smallest ones. And so I wanted to talk about that in First Home and to really acknowledge that that was my first home, no matter how short of a time period it was, because what I moved when I was 16 months old. And so I don't think that's something to, you know, underestimate just because I was a baby. And so I really wanted to talk about that time and what it meant. And, you know, it gave me the opportunity to have this conversation with my mother about immigrating and with my father about immigrating and how tough of a time it was for them as parents, because, you know, they were, my mother had me when she was 33 years old. My father was 34. And, you know, that's, I'm much older now than when my parents came to this country. And so to write about that, I felt was so significant to talk about and to open up the collection when it comes to leaving. So I think, you know, when it comes to have left the Philippines, you know, the motherland, that was not a decision that I made, but it was a decision my parents made. And it's something that I had to just go along with, you know, without choice, without agency. And so that was why I opened up this piece, because I wanted to explore what leaving meant when it's not your decision. Because I think when we think about leaving, we think about it being a conscious choice. Right. But I think for me, having left the Philippines at such a young age, like that wasn't my choice, but I left anyway. So it's going through like, so, you know, in terms of exploring the definition of leaving throughout the rest of the collection, I wanted to explore the different ways of how we leave.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's, you're such a thoughtful writer. Whenever I hear you talk about your books, I could just listen forever. And I think that the most, why I call this a magnum opus is this is such an in-depth book. There's so many different layers to it, but just so people who are following along, and I want to talk about the second story next, about when you go back to the motherland, but you just, I mean, the way you write, Las Piñas was my home for my first 16 months, the home of infant dreams, where memories dissolved before they could materialize into words. displacement eventually found its way in a restless 16-month-old traveling to new places and crowded airports and crowded airplanes. I mean, just the way it'd be very easy to say, oh, my mom took me on a flight, right?
Right, exactly.
But you make it beautiful and the blood curling screams. And, you know, writing creative nonfiction, this is why it's creative. It's because you're taking what some might say is a somewhat routine thing, being at an airport on a plane, and you're describing it as a 16-month, which you don't remember, right? Mm-hmm. I'm assuming you don't have conscious remembrance of that,
right.
But your mom can tell you how you were, and you can verbalize it on the page. I mean, you make it look easy, but there's a lot of layers there. You had to interview your mother. You had to go back. You had to set yourself in place and time. And I have this theory recently that I've been working with when I do workshopping about place. And I have this theory is if you choose a place with resonance that really matters to you, that or someone in a place with resonance, that the story will come out on its own.
Right.
Like magic almost. Because it's that those ancestors, it's your muscle memory, it's your thoughts, it's your family. It's like speaking to you in a way, the universe, to tell the story. And that's what your writing feels like to me. Like there's something moving through you to put this on the page. Do you ever feel that when you're writing?
Oh, absolutely. I think like when it comes to writers, I think we do a sort of channeling or conjuring from God knows what. I mean, even for writers that are atheists, I think there's something about the way we write that it definitely comes from some place deep within ourselves, even deep beyond ourselves, that is inexplicable. And you know, when that moment hits, when it's time to write, you just have to write it before it's gone, you know?
Yeah.
And you don't know where it's going to take you, except that, you know, it has to be written down and that's it. Like you just have to write it down without question. I do agree. Like I feel kind of like we're vehicles in that respect. That we're just like something is being communicated through us. Like even though it's coming from us, it also feels like it's coming from a place that is very much unknown.
Definitely. Yeah. And you know, when I read this book like 3 times, and when I did my long review of it, the thing I found really interesting that I really did not understand until after I thought about your book at length, reread it, thought about it at length, is why we connect. So I think we just have a lot in common. We're both lawyers, we're both writers, but even more so, our fathers both come from lower means. And my dad wasn't an immigrant, but he was from Great Falls, Montana, and kind of always felt like an outsider. My dad grew up very poor and he was in an orphanage for a time. Your father, you go back to where your father is from, which is now known as San Juan, but back in the day, was it La Pog. And he grew up in a barrio. And so talk about that. Like, what was that like? So you talked about writing your story from your mother's perspective when you were a baby. What about your father? Did you have to interview him as well?
I did interview him. And I think one of the things about interviewing him, because one of the things about my father is that he was a very strict parent growing up, to the point where we had a very contentious relationship. And it was really hard seeing my dad outside of the very strict disciplinarian role. And I think, you know, as I got older, that I started to really see my dad, not as my dad, but as a very complex human being with his own vulnerabilities. And exploring that origin story was really important to forgiving actually the type of relationship that we had had. Which I know is a really hard thing to do, right? For a lot of children who have, you know, a lot of adult children who have contentious relationships with their parents. Sometimes it's really hard to see your parent as that child, you know, who probably just needed like, you know, love and support and understanding as much as you did.
And no, I mean, just really quick.
Yeah.
You know how much I can identify with this.
Yeah.
My mom still can't hug very well. Mm-hmm. But I see my mom as a little kid now. Like when I look at her, I don't see the scary mom when I was a kid. I see this very loving, tender, almost childlike person that really would do anything for me now. And I do think memoir can be writing the memoir. I hate when people say it's like, you know, it's therapy. It's not therapy, but in writing the memoir, and if you want to make your characters true, you have to figure out who your parents are.
Exactly.
At their core.
Right.
Who are they? We're all hurt little kids, right?
Yeah. And I think it was just, really finding out exactly like who he was, where he grew up, that really shaped his decisions, shaped who he was as a parent and all of those things, which is very, very complicated and messy. And I think to go back to the place, like to revisit that time, you know, because I was 10 years old when I had gone back for the first time to my father's body. And then the second time was in my 30s, in my early 30s. And I went back, which was a totally different perception as well. And to also see how much the landscape had not changed, and then also how it did change. But seeing how it did not change really at least gave me a glimpse to the kind of little boy he had been. Mm. And to have grown up in that environment and then be diasporic later as an immigrant in a continent that is so far away from where you were raised, I mean, to me, that's like just like could be traumatic for anybody.
Yeah.
And so, you know, writing that story, Aswang Hunger, it was a way of connecting with my dad about our ancestral land, which it's one of those things where it's like, if you don't ask, you won't necessarily get the answers. And so for me to, like, I didn't know about, like, his environmental understanding of our ancestral land. Like that blew me away. And, you know, my dad's a soil scientist. That's what he was like in his career. And, you know, he pursued something that it was just really like the soil was deeply in his bones. And I think the fact that, you know, when we had these conversations, when I'd go home and we'd talk about like the barrio and where he grew up and our ancestral land, like he was just so full of knowledge that I just felt was passed down from the ancestors. Like it was his own, you know, oral storytelling that he held on to. And in that way, he was just as much, or he is just as much a storyteller as I am, except I do it through the written word while he does it, you know, in the traditional ancestral way of, you know, telling stories out loud.
Has he read this book?
No, he has not. That's another complicated matter with, you know, my family not reading my book.
Well, you know, this AWP, I did this panel with Hannah Sweard, Lori Markvart, and Nakia Cheney, and one other person who I'm blanking on. But we did this panel, and it was about telling true stories and how hard that can be, right? Yeah. And part of the thing we talked about is whether you let your family read your work or not, whether you tell them about it. And, you know, everyone has their own way of doing it. And I actually think that's okay, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, so there's another poet. She is, I believe she's Indonesian. She's queer. She's New York based. Her name is Dena Agusti. And she writes about very difficult family subjects. Very taboo. And I remember we had a very quick DM exchange over Instagram because she writes about such difficult subjects as much as I am. And I had read one of her interviews, and the question that was asked, and the question that gets asked of me time and time again, is like, what does your family think about your stories and your books? And we both have answered the same, you know, answer, saying like, we don't know. Like, I think the thing is that when it comes to writing these stories down about really difficult subjects, I feel like if I had my family over my shoulder, I wouldn't be able to write these stories down at all. I think I'd feel like I was being surveilled. And so I do have to
put you know what's funny? The person I forgot is the person who kind of uses your tactic. Her name's Toni Ann Johnson. She wrote this beautiful, auto-fictional account of her life called Light Skin Gone to Waste. And her family, her mom hasn't read it for the most part, and she doesn't keep in contact with her mother. But I think it's interesting that it's okay whichever way you go, right?
Yeah. I think, you know, everyone's process is different. And I think when we're writing about difficult subjects as we do, sometimes we do have to just stake a claim to our stories and have agency over them. And I think, like, if my family wants to read it, it's fine. I can't stop them. I can't stop anyone from reading my stories. That's right. But I think, like, you know, my entire family knows I'm a writer. They know I've written books. But it's also like remembering that because the subject matter is so difficult to read it from my point of view, it's like, it's one of those things. It's like, oh my God, I already know what happened. Why do I have to know how else sees it? You know what I mean? It's like, I was there. I know. And so I think there's that aspect to it as well, where it's so extraordinarily painful that they could already know what the content is. And yet at the same time, giving respect and distance to tell it also as my truth.
Definitely, definitely. And I mean, you write so beautifully anyways.
Oh, thank you.
You know, and I just think that there's a beauty to making even hard topics still beautifully said.
Right.
And you definitely do that. Talk a little bit, too, about your grandmother. She plays a role in this book, right? So we have the whole generations, your mother, father, you as a baby, and then your grandmother, Lola.
So one of the things about telling stories about my Lola, I mean, she's passed away. She passed away back in 2010.
I'm so sorry.
That she told me so many stories when I was younger, and you know, we used to share a bedroom together when she would visit from the Philippines. And, you know, when I say visit from the Philippines, it means like stay for 6 months sort of thing. So, you know, I had the privilege of sharing a bedroom with her, you know, for most of my childhood, my adolescence, you know, being a teenager. And in those years that she stayed with us, like she just told me so many stories. And I felt like I needed to tell those stories. And, you know, one of those is about my grandfather's murder. And when I was growing up, like my mother never talked about her dad, like ever. And,
interesting.
You know, it's extraordinarily painful to talk about it. And I understand. But I also felt like it was a story that needed to be told or it would totally be forgotten. And I think like looking at my grandfather's story contribute to a larger landscape of, you know, American history and Filipino American history and Philippine history, I thought was so significant that it needed to be told. Because I think when we look at, you know, subjects like the World War II and, you know, the involvement of the Philippines and you know, what it looked like for, you know, Filipino Americans and what that looked like for US history, there isn't really any details of the very intimate human experience. I think in order for us to appreciate any kind of history, not just from the history books, is to really look at our own families and how they contributed to that. And so writing the story is not just about, you know, uncovering like my own family's history, but how really it's part of the larger landscape of American history, of Philippine history, of World War II history. And I thought that was so valuable in writing that down, especially because, you know, if calling it World War II, the whole world was involved in World War II. And where were you in that moment? Where were your grandparents?
It says so much, right? There's a new series out on Hulu that's based on a book called We Were the Lucky Ones. And it's about World War II in Poland and this whole family that gets separated. And you're right. That it's almost like, where were you on 9/11? Where were you? Where was your grandfather during World War II, right? Where were your parents? Were they alive?
Yeah. And I think for me, like I didn't have any intention that I was going to carry on this investigative journalism project. That was not my intention. It was a purely organic experience of learning about, I'm not going to spoil it, but learning about how my grandfather was murdered. And then from there, it really shaped what I thought about my mom, what I thought about my own grandfather and his relationship to our, you know, our motherland and to the United States itself. And also just the fact that we're in the United States, how would he feel about that? I've like definitely questioned that a lot if he were still alive. And so, you know, looking at these stories and looking at the stories that were told to me, I just thought it was so important. And also it was a way of making my grandparents immortal. You know, it was really immortalizing them because they're not here anymore. But the sense of writing the story, it's like you conjure them that they are here and they're always here and they're never gonna go anywhere. And it's really interesting to have written about a man who died at the age of 28, and I never met him, but in writing his story, I felt so close to him. And I still feel close to him. Yeah, it's, I can't even explain what that feels like or what that experience is like, but
I know what you mean. You know, I wrote about my little brother, David, who I never met.
Right.
He died before I was born.
Yes. And it's just when you write about them, you conjure them and they come alive on the page. And having this relationship with them, it's a really just, you know, interesting is just not the word. But it's just this very supernatural experience, I guess you can call it. And
especially considering that your mom never talked about her father, probably because she was young when he passed away, right?
Yeah, she was 4 months old, I think.
Yeah. So she probably never really, I mean, she didn't know him either, except through her mother's stories. And who knows if your grandmother ever told her the story she told you. It's really interesting, right?
Yeah. And I think that's the thing about storytelling, right? Like storytelling keeps people alive even when they're gone. And I think like, so a lot of the stories that she received about her father were from her mother. So my Lola Feli, and then my grandfather's eldest sister. And so she had two sources. So in that respect, she had two mothers. And she does say she had two mothers. So I think also it's like this theme of like, what does it mean to be a parent? You know, because I think in like the white Western sense, it's like mom and dad or two parents, right? Like the whole, like it takes a village. It's like, that's like a vanishing idea. But I think like in this, you know, in this collection, I really wanted to bring it out how when it comes to like family and home, it's not limited to one definition.
Yeah. And, you know, what hints do you have for writers who are listening in about how to tell these stories? This is not easy stuff to go back generations. How did you do it? Did you tape record when you interviewed people, or did you just write notes and then recreate it later? How do you go about kind of memorializing your family's history?
Honestly, I don't record. I actually don't even take notes. I literally sit in the moment. And I have a weird way of memorizing moments through observing movement. That's a big thing that I do. And my brain just works like that. I know people have like, God, your memory's so like insane. How do you remember stuff like that? I mean, I can't explain it. I just do. Like I just can sit like this, you know, in this moment and really remember like movements of like, you know, how someone moved their shoulder or touched their face or smiled or.
Interesting.
Yeah. And bringing that nuance, you know, out so that the person becomes real on the page so that when someone reads them, it's like they know them like I know them.
I love that. I love that. And I do think there is a trick to interviewing in general, but especially interviewing your family members, to not make it an interview. It's right, just exactly. A talk, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I do regret I never interviewed my Aunt Tilly before she passed. I had bought a tape recorder. I was going to make it official and go to her nursing home bedside, and I didn't do it in time. But whenever you talk to my mom, I don't take notes or anything like that. I just remember that. My mom has a way of telling a story, like you said, the way she moves, the way she tells it, her quirky mannerisms that I could never forget about, you know, my mom, you know, arguing with her neighbor about this, about her manager, or whatever my mom's story is to me. It remains imprinted in my mind, the way my mom told it, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's what it, you know, I think when it comes to storytelling, that we have to remember the nuances and the quirks of people that, you know, make us human. You know, like even with your best friends that you talk with, like, it's not like you carry around a notebook, like every time you have a conversation. No, you're in that moment and you're present and you're relishing in everything that they're telling you. And I think that's so valuable. And so when we go back to tell that story, it's really tapping in to the emotional core of that interaction in order to tell that story really well. And also the way I tell stories is, I'm like, as you've seen the way that the beginning of Leaving is structured, it's not a linear story from beginning to end.
At all. Yeah.
No, not at all. Cause you know, that's not how our minds work really. I mean, like we have a memory, it triggers this, it triggers that, you know, and I really wanted to capture even like how we think in stories. And so the way that I chose, you know, What We Were Meant To and First Home about leaving, and because, you know, the poem itself is really a general commentary about diasporic leaving as a community, as a people, and then really diving in microscopically about how that looks like for a little baby. And then I wanted to bring it home at the very end with the beginning of Leaving, you know, with that title piece in Australia, because that was the first time that leaving took place under my own decision-making. And definitely. So I really wanted to make that contrast in order to bring it home.
Yeah. And let's talk about the sequencing. How did you, from a writer's perspective, when you're organizing this, did you have all the stories printed out and then you just kind of move them around? Like, for example, Happenstance, which you meet a woman from Seattle, I think, and you guys go swimming together and you talk about not being Filipino enough in the motherland. We're at page 165. That's kind of in the middle of the book. And you're like, how did that get there? But it makes sense there.
Right.
With the non-linear kind of like, we kind of see where your mind is going, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, one of the things is that, so I placed Starry Knees, which is the story of my niece.
Mm-hmm.
I love that story. I juxtaposed it next to Stone because I wanted to do a huge jump in time for my grandfather to meet his great granddaughter in that way. So to juxtapose them like generationally,
interesting.
It was like having them meet.
And I don't think we would know that as the reader. It's not something that you ever say, I don't think.
No.
But it's really, this is why I love this show. It's these little Easter eggs I get that I find.
Yeah.
These little things that you would never know unless you were the writer. Like, for example, Stephanie Barbie Hammer was on my podcast and she said something about my book being influenced by The Wizard of Oz. And I was like, I never say that. I think I mentioned The Wizard of Oz once.
Right.
With reference to my twin sister reading it. But Wizard of Oz is a huge influence on all my work. And so no one would ever know that except me, that someone figured it out. And you here with that connection with the, you know, with the generations and bringing them together in this collection next to each other. Oh, my goodness. It's so beautiful. And it's so intentional.
Right. And so the thing is, like, the way I place Starry Knees and Happenstance, because Starry Knees really also is a story where my sister is also in, right? Mm-hmm. To go to Happenstance and meet this Pinay who's from Seattle, and mm-hmm. we used to work in the same building at the J.P. Morgan Chase building in San Francisco. To meet her in the Philippines, it's a different kind of sisterhood. I did that parallel. I did that jump. I mean, I don't know if anyone actually notices, but for me, it's the way I structured this essay collection is very intentional. It's not by accident. Like, there is a weaving that goes through this as if I were doing it, you know, on a loom.
Every single podcast episode where I ask this question, like for one example, one writer told me that out of 100 poems, the first and the 51st would always mirror each other, the second and the 52nd. Mm. Stuff like that, right? Where there is a magical but purposeful intention to it all. Like, for those writers who think you just slap your book together, it's not. No, people can, and that's okay. Some people do it in a much more organized way where they do an outline. But I love the books and the writers that do it intuitively.
Yeah.
Like, why is 5 years at the beginning of Ziggy Stardust? It's mm-hmm. talking about the end of the world and him crying, right? So it's like, that's why. Because when you do it organically, but also intentionally, it's magic. It's magical. It's speaking from a place deeper than ourselves that are conscious, right? Right now I'm reading Macbeth for class. And when I read Macbeth, Shakespeare, or whoever Shakespeare was or whoever wrote it, there's mm-hmm. a magic to the way that it's sequenced too. So I think all great works of art, but especially the beginning of Leaving, this could not have been an easy book to organize. Did it take a long time? Like, talk about the writing process. How many years?
Well, let's see. I got to take a look. I have to look at that. You know, some of the pieces were written again, as I said, like almost 10 years ago. Like, you know, Star, for example, is so when she was 7 at the time that this story took place, she's 16 years old today.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, when I wrote that story, I wrote it fresh in my memory when she did fall down, you know, and I had to write it down. And it was such a compelling story. And I remember when I first wrote it and my sister saw it. She and you know, because my sister was also reliving that moment when Star fell on her knees. It just like was like, oh my goodness, that did happen. And it's funny, my niece who's 16, I don't think, I mean, she hasn't read this book yet, because it's a little bit rated R. But I
not really, just a couple parts, I guess. Yeah,
a couple parts. Yeah. It would be interesting to.
But again, even the rated R parts you make beautiful, so no one would complain. Yeah,
It would be interesting to find out her take on, like, if she remembers what happened that day when she fell. So,
yeah, it would be interesting because, you know, us as writers, you know, I would say, you know, it's your friend for having a wife that's a writer, or your friend, your fault for having a friend that's a writer. We're going to write about you, right?
Right. And
you can't help it, but you never think of what they're going to. My mom now is great. Like, she. I'm convinced she just lets it go in one ear and out the other. If she's at a reading, she doesn't say anything anymore. And that's the best kind of reader to have, someone with no complaints, you know?
Yeah.
That's in your book. Talk a little bit, because we have about 5 minutes before I want to get to your last reading. talk about what's next on the horizon for you. Are you working on another book?
I am in the process of editing my third book, which is my debut poetry collection, which is called Giving Birth in a Time of War. And that book is going to be dedicated to my mother. But that poetry collection, again, you know, it's exploring different definitions of how we give birth. And I don't mean like, I mean, I do mean literally of how we give birth, but also I also mean it figuratively on how we give birth, you know, to ourselves, to our identity, to our femininity, things of that nature. And because that's a birthing in itself. So
and,
I
explore and that's those. Purely poetry?
It's purely poetry. All of it is poetry. Oh. So, and that's going to be published by Jaded Ibis Press in March 2025.
Oh my gosh. So your third book is coming out. How you got to come on again.
Yes, of course. Yes, I would love to.
I've had a couple people on twice, no one three times. So you're going to be my three times a charm person. Okay. Just before we get into your final reading, tell people where they can find you and your work. I also want to tell everyone to get your two books, The Beginning of Laving, available on Carencia Press, as well as We Are No Longer Babylon. And that's by New Rivers Press. That's from 2020. And The Beginning of Leaving was published last year. So tell people how they can find you. And then if you could end us with at least a 5-minute reading of prose, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah. So The Beginning of Leaving, you can find it at whatever book retailer you want. It's everywhere. And if you want to find more information about me, my website is slicingtomatoes.com. There you can find more information about The Beginning of Leaving, as well as my first book, We Are No Longer Babylon. And, you know, and also like previous works, if you wanted to look at, you know, poetry and prose that I had published previously in literary journals. So,
yay.
Let me see. I'm going to read. Give me a second.
Yeah. And just while you're doing that really quick, I'm going to tell everyone again, please go to the Life of Jam Facebook page. And if you could comment or review the podcast and put a note on my page, you can just even put it on the page itself, or you could DM me and I will send you a copy of Elsa's book. I have a copy of each to give away. I have a copy of The Beginning of Leaving to give away. Or you could just share this podcast. That's another way. You could share this podcast, the audio version on your page, on your Facebook page, or do an Instagram post for it. And then I could also, I have another copy of We Are No Longer Bye-Bye Land, and I can send that out too. So two winners, chicken dinners for these beautiful books. If you somehow share, post, review anything, you know, or if you buy Elsa's book, send me a note and I can send you the other book. So whoever does that first, I have two copies to give away. So Elsa, take it away with your next reading. Let us know what page you're reading from for people who are following along.
Sure. So this is page 170 and it's called How Not to Drown. And I'm actually going to do a little shout out. So I was actually talking to a really dear friend of mine and we were talking about swimming. So I wanted to read this piece. Actually, I wasn't planning to read the piece, but, you know, since we had talked about swimming, I thought I was going to read this piece. I'm doing a shout out to this person. And also, so when it comes to leaving, this piece particularly is about leaving behind fear. So here goes, How Not to Drown. One. I didn't learn to swim until I was 16. I grew up 20 minutes from the ocean, but it doesn't mean you know. The blood of island people runs through my veins. Still, it doesn't mean you know. Women in my family had grown up by the ocean. Still, they didn't know. Why not, you ask? Women couldn't. Just as they couldn't ride bikes, as my mother told me, my Lola said girls who rode bikes broke their hymens. And if your hymen was broken, a man would never want you. Maybe the ocean was seen as sensual, the same exhilaration felt during orgasm. Again, another belief: orgasms were not meant for women. Swim. Now, I command myself as they snorkel in Fiji, Sangat, Leyte, Maui, Oahu, Kauai, Mjangan, Vieques. Don't hyperventilate. Don't question the physics. And yet the questions still flood. How is it possible to stay afloat? Brightly colored fish swim past my fingers, temporarily reminding me what I have always known in the womb. After a day of work in San Francisco, while waiting for the bus, I'd imagine swimming to the tops of skyscrapers when I would suddenly think of drowning, the waters closing in like an infestation of ants. I remind myself, you know how. 2. I learned to swim at 16, which may be considered not that late, but I was old enough that the fear of water seeped deep into my psyche than if I were to have learned at 7 or 8 when everyone else had learned. I learned to ride a bike at 12 when everyone else had learned at 5. With learning to bike, I was not so afraid. With swimming, I can never shake the fear of drowning that greets me when I first step into water. And it takes rational reminding that swimming is an act of physics. I will not drown if I just swim, as I have learned all of those decades ago. My mother could only dream of swimming. My mother eventually learned to swim at 49. Fear still there for both of us. Throughout college and law school, which amounted to 7 years total, I swam at least 3 to 4 times a week, to every weekend, to almost every night at one point, swimming the freestyle for 2 straight hours without pause, to shake the fear of water, to build my stamina in it. In the deep end, with each stroke, I'd stare at the pool floor 10 feet below as if I were flying. Even the lifeguard would take notice and marvel at my endurance when I'd finally climb out of the pool and have submerged myself in the jacuzzi, my muscles melting in the heat and steam, transforming from frightened human to peaceful jellyfish. You are such a good swimmer with good form. But what does praise matter when the fear of drowning dictates first? 3. At 44, while visiting a Pinay sister in the Bahamas, she would simply tell me to speak with the ancestors while we swam. This ancestral communication should have come as second nature to me. Instead, she switched the light on in my brain. My Pinay sister could not ride a bike, but she could swim in open water for miles. There's a sadness here amidst the beauty. Do you feel it? The blood of island ancestors ran through both our veins. My Pinay sister, having grown up a diasporic child in the Bahamas, told me of the Luku Kairi's absence, a resounding mourning echo between land and sea. She reminded me that the turquoise waters were never just paradise, but a final resting place where slave ships had discarded 3 million Africans into this very sea. Our own Filipino ancestors circumnavigated the world as slaves on Spanish galleon ships. And now, 435 years later, we diasporic granddaughters were swimming in their space. Please, ancestors, she implored as she swam half a mile out to explore a rock in the middle of the sea. Please, ancestors, I implored, when the age-old fear suddenly cut me loose. The next morning, while snorkeling, I spent a peaceful minute treading by myself, not caring at all about the fish, but I calmly watched the swaying surface of the water as I felt, for once, a gentle immersion that accepted me wholly in return.
I love that piece, and to get to hear you read it, and it's about so much more, right?
Yeah.
I'm a swimmer, so I know exactly what you mean about there's, it's almost like watching subtitles when you lose yourself in swimming. Mm-hmm. Like there's a vanishing point where you forget you're swimming because you're so at home in the water, and it becomes like second nature to you. So beautifully done.
Yeah. Thank you.
I love this book so much. So everyone stick around after we say goodbye, Elsa, if you don't mind, but everyone go get The Beginning of Leaving. Please, please, please. It's such a beautiful book. Okay. Well, we're going to say goodbye. Thank you so much, Elsa. I hope to have you on when your next book comes
out. Yes, absolutely. Thank you for having me, Jem. It's always delightful to see you.
Yes. And go to Elsa's website, slicingtomatoes.com.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a great day, everybody. See you later. Bye.